Chapter 3. His Military Life. The motives which led Mr. Miller to resign his public position as a civil officer and enter upon the arduous and perilous theater of military life have been stated in the preceding chapter. Among the honors conferred on him in the military department at the time of his advancement in the civil was his election to the office of lieutenant by superseding a commissioned officer who expected it by promotion. His lieutenant's commission is dated July 21, 1810. It is signed Jonas Galusha, Governor of Vermont. To some of the readers of this work, the form of the oath taken on entering upon the duties of such an office may be of interest. A copy of that oath, found on the back of Mr. Miller's commission, is as follows. I, William Miller, solemnly swear that I will be true and faithful to the state of Vermont, that I will not directly nor indirectly do any act or thing injurious to the Constitution or a government thereof, as established by convention, so help me God. I also swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States. W. M. Miller, August 13, 1810. The foregoing oaths were taken and subscribed to before me, Caleb Hendy, Jr., Brigadier General. The reader will see that this commission is dated about 2 years prior to the declaration of war with England by the United States. The premonitions of that war, however, were already seen. On the 18th of June, 1812, the declaration was made in due form, and the first note of preparation found Mr. Miller with hundreds of his hardy and patriotic Green Mountain neighbors ready to take the field. A very short time after, it was announced that he would take his place at the head of a company of state volunteers, the ranks were filled. And on the day after the date of the act of the state government of Vermont, which authorized the raising of such a body, his captain's commission is dated. It is presumed that very few of Mr. Miller's particular friends will feel any special interest in these details of warlike affairs. It is nothing more nor less to them on account of his connection with these matters. But it is not so with all who may read this work. The fact that he honored these public and responsible offices, which men were accustomed to regard with so much respect, would weigh more on the question of competency in the estimation of many very worthy people than the purest Christian deportment in ordinary life. His true military station has also been misstated, and it is the work of the biographer and historian to give facts as they are. The question of Mr. Miller's rank and soldierly character can be presented in its true light by the use of authentic documents in fewer words than can do the question justice in any other form. And these documents must be decisive. No other reasons need to be stated for employing them. His captain's commission in the Vermont Volunteers is in these words. L.S. By His Excellency Jonas Galusha, Esquire, Captain General, Governor, and Commander-in-Chief in and over the state of Vermont. To William Miller, Esquire, greeting. You, being elected a captain of a company of infantry in the 1st Brigade of Volunteers of this state, and reposing special trust and confidence in your patriotism, valor, and good conduct, I do, by virtue of these presents, in the name and by the authority of the freemen of the state of Vermont, fully authorize and empower you, the said William Miller, to take charge of the said company as their captain, pursuant to an act for raising a corps of volunteers, passed November 6, 1812. You will, therefore, carefully and diligently discharge the said duty by doing and performing every matter and thing thereunto relating. You will observe and follow such orders and directions as you shall, from time to time, receive from the governor of the state for the time being, or any other your superior officers, according to military discipline and the laws of this state. And all officers and soldiers under your command are to take notice hereof, and yield due obedience to your orders as their captain, in pursuance of the trust in you reposed. In testimony whereof, I have caused the seal of this state to be hereunto affixed, given under my hand in council chamber at Montpelier, the 7th day of November, in the year of our Lord 1812, and of the independence of the United States, the 37th. Jonas Galusha, by His Excellency's command, R.C. Mallory, Secretary. This company being filled up, organized, and authorized to take the field, pursuant to orders, next came the scene of trial to a soldier, only inferior to the hour of battle, that of bidding adieu to home and all that is dear to the heart of man associated with home. This was an exciting and deeply affecting scene. Skepticism was silenced before the working of nature, of reason, and the proprieties of such a moment as decided by all nations, pagan, Jewish, and Christian. How could these noble-hearted men, husbands, sons, brothers, part with those who were dearer to them than life itself, under circumstances they might properly regard as not very unlike to those of a dying hour, without asking the benediction of the Almighty? It was impossible. But it was not generally expected by those who knew Captain Miller as a deist and a railer at the devout that the devotions of this solemn leave-taking would be anything more than a ceremony in which he would act the part of a constrained or indifferent spectator. Judge, then, of the effect when he was seen to take his former friend, who was present with the multitude, by the hand, and with a grace and tenderness which all felt to be in full tone with the occasion, and under deep emotion, present him to the company as the man of God, with whom they would join in prayer. The chaplain on this occasion was Elder Kendrick, who had felt and maintained a special interest in Mr. Miller, in spite of his deism, from the first of his acquaintance with him. In his prayer, all the interest he felt in the members of the company, many of whom were his neighbors, in Captain Miller, as a promising family relative of his most intimate Christian friends, and in the great public occasion as a patriot, was poured out with the most becoming solemnity, affection, and fervency. The effect was almost overpowering. It is fresh in the memory of those present to this day. Captain Miller's company, with the great body of volunteers raised in that region, was ordered to Burlington, which was expected to be the theater of war for that campaign. The fatigue of the march and an accident which proved almost fatal to Mr. Miller are described in the following letter to his wife. Camp at Burlington, June 13, 1813. Dear Lucy, I am now at this place after a fatiguing march. My feet are worn all out, and my body is very sore. On our march from Bennington to this place, I met with an accident which almost deprived me of life. The last day of our march, my feet and ankles being very lame, I hired a passage in a wagon with four or five of my brother officers. Captain Clark and myself got into the hind part of the wagon, and while fixing the seat, the horses started and threw me out. I fell on the back part of my head, and they have since informed me that I lay as if dead for 15 or 20 minutes. They put me into the wagon and carried me 5 or 6 miles before I came to my senses. My head is still very sore. Ensign Dake was in the wagon and paid the strictest attention to me. I have not much news of consequence to write. We expected the British in at Burlington every hour. There were about 1,000 men came in yesterday and today from Bennington and Windsor, and we are ready to meet them with any force they can bring against us. I have nothing more to write, but to subscribe myself, your ever-loving husband, William Miller. On his arrival at Burlington, Mr. Miller was transferred from the Volunteers of the State of Vermont to the regular Army of the United States. He first took the rank of lieutenant and was immediately ordered back to Rutland County to attend to the recruiting service, as the following general order will show. Encampment, Burlington, June 13, 1813. Sir, you are hereby commanded to repair to the county of Rutland and there attend to the recruiting service for the 30th Regiment Infantry in U.S. Army. You will govern yourself by the laws of the United States and return to this post when commanded. Mason Ormsby, Major, Infantry, to Lieutenant William Miller, U.S. Army. Such a transfer is considered honorable in the military sense, and the change of service, which allowed Mr. Miller to enjoy the comforts of home and the attention of friends, while suffering from his late accident, must have been very acceptable. But there were reasons for the arrangement which bear most favorably on his reputation. The Army was in great want of men who could be relied upon under the dangers which threatened from the enemy in the direction of Canada, and there were few men who could accomplish so much in bringing them into the service as Mr. Miller. He was very generally known and highly respected in the region assigned him. He was warmly devoted to the service, so that his example had a powerful effect, and the returns, which official documents fully exhibit, demonstrate the wisdom of directing his efficiency to this department of the service. He was employed in raising recruits till 1814, but this period of comparative repose was of short duration. He was thus remanded to headquarters, Cantonment, Burlington, July 7, 1813, Lieutenant William Miller at Pulteney. You are hereby commanded to join your regiment at Burlington immediately and report yourself to the commanding officer, Elias Fassett, Colonel, 30th Infantry. Soon after his return to Burlington, in July of 1813, Mr. Miller was called to suffer another of the dangers of army life, which, on many accounts, is quite as serious as those of the battlefield. The army fever, which broke out among the troops at Burlington, has already been referred to. So alarming were its ravages that the great body of the army, quartered in or near the town, was removed several miles into the more elevated country east of the lake. A change from the humid atmosphere and bad water of one locality, which aggravated, if they did not cause the distemper, to the salubrious air and pure water of the other locality, could not fail of producing a happy effect. But those who were too feeble to be removed, and those who could obtain suitable accommodations in the town, remained. Mr. Miller was among these. One of the very common, most lamentable, and mortifying evils of war is the absolute dependence of the poor soldier on those whose avarice or profligacy rob him of all the comforts and often of the necessaries which his country may provide for him. The medical department of the army too often furnishes this form of the horrors of war. When a mere reckless pretender to the title of his profession, who has become disqualified for any station in civil society, obtains a place in this department, the life of a soldier is thought as little of as the life of a dog. It would be far more desirable to face the cannon of the enemy than to fall into such hands. How many of the brave soldiers at Burlington, who found so undesirable an end, were indebted to official aid for that result is unknown. Happy were those who could provide for themselves. Mr. Miller was thus favored. His fever bore a greater resemblance to the common bilious fever than to the prevailing epidemic. But the same potations, dealt out so profanely by the bloated official to the dying around him, were prescribed for the young officer from Pulteney. He knew the danger and sternly refused to take the stuff. He immediately put himself under the care of one of the resident physicians of the village, Dr. Littlefield, whose name is still remembered in the family of Mr. Miller with sentiments of affectionate gratitude. At the time now referred to, Burlington appeared much more like a camp than like a place devoted to the peaceful pursuits of commerce and learning. As it was the most important United States settlement on the shores of Lake Champlain, it was generally expected that the English forces would be concentrated here for its conquest or destruction. The regular routine of college exercises was suspended, and the halls of learning were appropriated to the sick and dying officers of the army. To enjoy such accommodations was esteemed a great favor. But these rooms were so much crowded, and such was the want of proper aid, that the air within every part of the building occupied was like a pestilential solvent for everything that passed into it. In one of these rooms, Mr. Miller was confined for several days after he was taken sick. As soon, however, as the tidings of his sickness reached Pulteney, his wife resolved to place herself at his bedside with as little delay as possible. An anxious and hurried ride in an open wagon brought her to witness such a scene of suffering and death as she had not before known. She found her husband quite as comfortable as she expected, but on entering his apartment, she saw that the prospect of help for him and of escape for herself was about equally dark. But what could she do? He could not be taken home. She was among strangers, and all that the generosity of the inhabitants could furnish, which was nobly brought forward, was needed to meet the common demand. Most providentially, there was another of her own sex on the premises who, although she had devoted her ample stock of bedding and other conveniences for the sick room to the common benefit of those who occupied the college, could still sympathize with a wife and mother in such affliction and cheerfully make the sacrifice that was needed to meet the case. This noble-hearted woman was Mrs. Cushman, whose husband had charge of the college boarding house. She invited Mrs. Miller into her spacious and airy parlor. She brought forward her unsoiled bed linen and other things on which the comfort of the sick so much depends, and generously devoted them, the parlor and its ample appendages, to the use of her afflicted visitor. But little time was needed to put all in order for the removal of the patient to this most inviting apartment. All the circumstances of the change combined to make its effects the most desirable. The fear of burdening Mrs. Cushman was the greatest difficulty in the way of feeling themselves at home. In the comparative quiet of this apartment, with the skillful attention of Dr. Littlefield and the constant attention of his wife, Mr. Miller exhibited the most gratifying indications of recovery. But as hope became strong in reference to him, there were reasons for alarm about Mrs. Miller. The fatigue of the journey to Burlington, the anxiety she felt for her husband, the constant care and labor required to make him comfortable, had prostrated her so far that she became peculiarly exposed to the infection of the pestilence. She was permitted only to rejoice in her husband's improvement before the usual premonitions of the dreaded malady appeared in her own system. As it was no longer indispensable that she should continue at Burlington, she resolved to fly from the infected region and run the risk of a failure in reaching home. Although her husband was afflicted by the thought of her leaving him, he was much more afflicted by the fear that she might be prostrated and fall into unkind hands on the journey, or even become helpless on the highway and die, as his grandfather Phelps had, by the same disease only a few months before. However, she ordered the lad who accompanied her to get the carriage ready, and bidding Mr. Miller farewell, she took the road towards Pulteney, which leads through the hilly country above the almost level slope which borders the lake. And after a moderate ride of 2 days, she arrived home in much better health than when she left Burlington. Although the sun was very hot, for this was in August, the pure, invigorating air of the mountains had restored the tone of her naturally vigorous constitution, and the alarming symptoms disappeared without medical aid. Mr. Miller was immediately informed of the beneficial effects of her journey, which had as good an effect on him as the best medicine could have, and his health soon became so much improved that he could resume the post of duty. As the enemy did not make their appearance in the vicinity of Burlington or on the east of Lake Champlain, arrangements were made to locate the American troops on the west side of the lake and to advance into Canada. Plattsburgh became the headquarters of one division of the troops. Burlington continued the headquarters for another. In the autumn of 1813, Mr. Miller had so far recovered as to cross over the lake, but the effects of his fever appeared in the form of a bad sore on his left arm. This became so painful and was so much of annoyance that a surgical operation was advised, which was to remove the affected parts of the flesh so as to cleanse the bone by scraping it. If this was not done, possibly amputation would be necessary. He was somewhat displeased by the rudeness of the thoughtless medical students or surgeons' mates, who too often seemed to think that a disabled soldier is good for nothing but to cut up for experiments. And as they handled the diseased limb one day somewhat roughly, and spoke very lightly of its amputation as a matter of course, he reminded them that his sword arm was still sound, and putting his hand on the hilt of his sword then before him, gave them to understand that whatever might be advised in the case, he should not submit to any unnecessary pain for their amusement. They understood him, and it ended their rudeness. This danger, however, was shortly over, and he was able to join his regiment in actual service while they were out in search of the enemy on the Canadian frontier. The particulars of this expedition are given in a letter to his wife, dated Chateauguay Four Corners, October 31, 1813. Lucy, I once more have the pleasure of writing to you, and am very sorry that I cannot tell you of hairbreadth escapes and dismal sights, hideous yells and war whoops, but so it is. I have seen nothing like an enemy, although I have been into Canada. I started from this place last Thursday to join my regiment, but meeting some officers, we were ordered to return to this place. The army is expected here in a few hours. They stayed only 3 or 4 miles back. They have had a number of skirmishes with Indians, and last Tuesday they had a general engagement with the whole British force, consisting of regulars, militia, and Indians, and it is said would have taken the whole was it not for the folly of some of our guides who led that part of our army astray which should have fallen on their rear. And they, being thus led astray and bewildered in the woods, the Indians fell upon them in the night and made considerable havoc among them. Night before last, they had another encounter with our piquet guard, and there were some killed and wounded on both sides. You will undoubtedly hear many stories, but the truth you will hardly get, for there are as many different stories here as there are men. I expect we shall be posted at this place, that is, the 30th Regiment, but wherever we may be, you will hear from me as often as you wish to. I have not heard from you since I came from home. Do write immediately and direct your letter to Lieutenant William Miller of 30th Infantry, Northern Army. William Miller. P.S. November 1st, 1813. I have joined my regiment and find all our soldiers alive and well from Pulteney. We lost none from our regiment, and only one wounded. It is said we lost 30 killed in said battle. We some expect an attack by the Indians soon. William Miller. These skirmishes closed the campaign of 1813 in this quarter, and while the great body of the troops under General Macomb were preparing at Burlington and Plattsburgh for more efficient operations the following year, Mr. Miller was engaged in the recruiting service in the vicinity of his residence and through the state of Vermont generally. He was at home on furlough when he received the following orders from the colonel of his regiment. Burlington, January 10, 1814, to Lieutenant William Miller. You will immediately repair to Pulteney and such other places as you think proper, and there attend to the recruiting service agreeable to your last instructions. Elias Fassett, Colonel, 30th Infantry. The year 1814 was to decide the contest between Great Britain and the United States. The former was able to bring her best troops into the field, and the latter must put forth all her resources to meet them. It seems almost impossible that human skill or strength could have brought about the result. There probably was no particular point of the general scene of the war where the circumstances of the American arms were of a more critical nature than at the point where Mr. Miller, with his brave countrymen, were to stand. Early in the year, and while he was searching out and sending into the field the recruits from the Green Mountains, he was promoted to the office of captain in the regular army. As this is the point in Mr. Miller's history which has been misapprehended by some who have referred to him publicly, although the fact involved is, to his friends, of but little interest, the document which makes all clear is given. Quote, "The President of the United States of America to all who shall see these presents, greeting. Know ye that reposing special trust and confidence in the patriotism, valor, fidelity, and abilities of William Miller, I have nominated, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to appoint him a captain in the 30th Regiment of Infantry in the service of the United States, to rank as such from the 31st day of January, 1814. He is therefore carefully and diligently to discharge the duty of captain by doing and performing all manner of things thereunto belonging. And I do strictly charge and require all officers and soldiers under his command to be obedient to his orders as captain. And he is to observe and follow such orders and directions from time to time as he shall receive from me, or the future President of the United States of America, or the general or other superior officers set over him according to the rules and discipline of war. This commission to continue in force during the pleasure of the President of the United States for the time being. Given under my hand at the city of Washington, this first day of February, in the year of our Lord, 1815, and in the 39th year of the independence of the United States. James Madison, by the President, James Monroe, Secretary of War." Close quote. The summons which brought him to the post of danger is of the following form and date. Burlington, August 12, 1814, to William Miller, Captain in the 30th Infantry. Sir, you are ordered to report yourself to the commanding officer of said regiment without delay at Plattsburgh. I am, sir, with respect, etc., etc., Elias Fassett, Colonel, 30th, and Commander, Recruiting. His promotion to a more responsible position subjected him to some very painful duties, and if we may credit the uniform testimony of his companions in arms, few men ever met the difficulties before him with greater ability or success. All the circumstances which led to the vacation of the office to which Mr. Miller was promoted need not be stated. But the said company of infantry passed under his command in a state of serious disorder. Such a state of things became the more threatening, as the approach of the enemy rendered it of the utmost importance that each company should be in a state of the greatest efficiency possible. The nature of the difficulties to be met, the course he pursued, and the result are stated in the following letter to his wife. Camp near Fort Moreau, in Plattsburgh, September 4, 1814, Sunday, 9 o'clock evening. Dear Lucy, I received your letter of the 30th and perceived by the contents that you received only $80. I enclosed $100 and think you must have been mistaken, for if any person had robbed the letter, they would have taken the whole. My soldiers were paid their money today, and I have had to go out twice since I have begun this letter to still the noise. I have found the company in a very wayward situation, but believe, by dint of application, I shall be able to bring them to good subordination. I have had to punish 4 or 5 of them very severely, and have reason to believe that they both love and fear me. One look is now sufficient to quell any disorder. This we call a payday, and once in 4 days we have a whiskey day, on which days I have 6 or 7 soldiers who will take a little too much, and then of all the devils in hell I think they must exceed in deviltry. But while in this situation I do not punish. After they become sober, I then punish them as I told them I would, and I find it has a good effect. One punishment which I inflict on soldiers is picketing. First, a gallows is raised, about 10 feet high. Then their arms are extended and fastened above by ropes. Then a picket drove into the earth, on which they are to stand until they receive sufficient punishment, and we seldom have to punish them the second time. I had one on the picket today for threatening to shoot one of my sergeants and swearing that he would not obey any officer except the captain. This, in an army, is a great crime. Therefore, I could do no less than to make a public example. When he was first put up, he was very turbulent and hoped he might die if he repented of what he said. But after standing 1 hour, he became as penitent as a lamb and prayed and begged to be released. "Oh, dear captain," said he, "do take me down. I shall die. I will never commit another crime. For heaven's sake, release me." I took him down, as you may well believe, and it wrung tears from my eyes to see how thankful the poor fellow was. But this is only the bad picture. In my next letter, I will show you the good side. The British are within 10 miles of this place, and we expect a battle tomorrow, and I think they must be damned fools if they do not attack us, as they are 10 or 11,000 strong, and we are only 1,500. But every man is determined to do his duty. It may be my lot to fall. If I do, I will fall bravely. Remember, you will never hear from me if I am a coward. I must close, as it is almost 11 o'clock. Remember your William Miller. This letter contains the only instance of the use of language approaching to the dialect of profanity, which has passed under the writer's notice in a large amount of Mr. Miller's manuscripts. Considering that he was a deist and a soldier at the time, instances of a more objectionable form might have been expected. And this was evidently owing to the peculiar vexations of the time. This letter is dated less than a week anterior to the most remarkable and bloody battle of Plattsburg. It was daily expected when he wrote. It seems almost surprising, in view of the known strength of the two armies, that he should have spoken as he did. This is the only bad picture. In my next letter, I will show you the good side. It is impossible to give a correct view of the perilous position of Mr. Miller and his fellow soldiers during this battle without stating, to some extent, the details of its history. The reader will not consider it out of place if quotations from works on such matters are here made, such as will place the danger and the courage of the subject of this memoir with other brave defenders of our country, and also the interposition of Providence, as it was regarded at the time, in their true light. Quote, "It had become an object of solicitude with the belligerent parties on the northern frontier to obtain the superiority on the lakes. Indeed, the success of the land operations was considered to be entirely dependent on that of the Marine. Commodore Perry had already established our dominion on Lake Erie, and that of Lake Ontario had been successfully disputed by Commodore Chauncey with Sir James Yeo. Vermont and New York were threatened from Lake Champlain. To counteract hostile attempts from this quarter, the command of the American squadron on this lake was entrusted to Commodore McDonough, while the defense of Plattsburgh depended on the exertions of General Macomb and his gallant little army. In September 1814, an attack was anticipated on these youthful commanders. Accordingly, on the 11th of that month, the expected event took place. Early in the summer of 1814, the Canadian frontier was reinforced by a large body of troops, which rendered the position of General Brown very critical. The British government, relieved from its long and severe struggle against Bonaparte, could dispose of many picked troops, disciplined under Wellington, and they were sent to Canada. For several days, the enemy had been on his way to Plattsburgh by land and water, and it was well understood that an attack would be made at the same time by his land and naval forces. Commodore McDonough determined to await at anchor the approach of the latter. General Macomb was frequently advised to retreat, to spare the blood and lives of his apology for an army, and save Plattsburgh from the fate of a conquered country. But the decision which he took, and to which he unwaveringly adhered in his apparently forlorn situation, proved the strength of his moral courage and the wisdom of his measures. At 8 o'clock in the morning, the lookout boat announced the approach of the enemy. At 9, he anchored in a line ahead at about 300 yards distance from the American line. His flagship, the Confiance, under Commodore Downie, was opposed to Commodore McDonough's ship, the Saratoga. The brig Linnet was opposed to the Eagle, Captain Robert Henley. The enemy's galleys, 13 in number, to the schooner, sloop, and a division of galleys, one of his sloops assisting his ship and brig, the others assisting his galleys, the remaining American galleys being with the Saratoga and Eagle. In this situation, the whole force on both sides became engaged. The Saratoga suffered much from the heavy fire of the Confiance, though the fire of the former was very destructive to her antagonist. The Ticonderoga, Lieutenant Commander Casson, gallantly sustained her full share of the action. At 10:30, the Eagle, not being able to bring her guns to bear, cut her cable and anchored in a more eligible position between the Saratoga and the Ticonderoga, where she very much annoyed the enemy, but unfortunately left her commodore exposed to a galling fire from the enemy's brig. The guns of the Saratoga on the starboard side being nearly all dismounted or not manageable, a stern anchor was let go, the bower cable cut, and the ship winded with a fresh broadside on the Confiance, which soon after surrendered. The broadside of the Saratoga was then sprung to bear on the brig, which surrendered within about 15 minutes. The sloop that was opposed to the Eagle had struck some time before and drifted down the line, the sloop which was with the enemy's galleys having also struck. Three of them were sunk, and the others pulled off, while McDonough's galleys were in the act of obeying the signal to follow them. All the vessels were reported to him to be in a sinking state. It then became necessary to counterman the signal to the galleys and order their men to the pumps. At this time, not a mast was standing in either squadron in a condition to hold up a sail, the lower rigging being nearly all shot away, hung down along the mast. The action lasted without intermission 2 hours and 20 minutes. An attack made by the British Army under the Governor-General of the Canada, Sir George Provost, on General Macomb, commanding at Plattsburgh, owed its defeat to the bravery of Commodore McDonough on the lake, and the undaunted valor of Macomb, commanding on shore. Sir George, having collected all the disposable force in Lower Canada, with a view of conquering the country as far as Crown Point in Ticonderoga, entered the territories of the United States on the 1st of September with 14,000 men and occupied the village of Champlain. As was before intimated, the cooperation of the naval force constituted an essential part of the arrangement. The consequence was that, instantly on the discomfiture of the fleet, the army retired with great precipitation, having lost 2,500 men in killed, wounded, and missing. This victory was announced to the Department of War by Commodore MacDonough on the day it was obtained in the following brief and modest communication. "The Almighty has been pleased to grant us a signal victory on Lake Champlain in the capture of one frigate, one brig, and two sloops of war of the enemy." It was in the midst of this scene of terror and carnage that Mr. Miller's courage was tried. Its effect on him is described, so far as words can describe it, in two letters, one of which was written even before the battle ended and is addressed to Judge Stanley of Pulteney. The other is addressed to Mrs. Miller. As both of these letters will be read with interest, they are inserted. The first is dated and reads as follows: "Fort Scott, September 11, 1814, 20 minutes past 2 o'clock p.m. "Sir, it is over. It is done. The British fleet has struck to the American flag. Great slaughter on both sides. They are in plain view where I am now writing. My God, the sight was majestic. It was noble. It was grand. This morning at 10 o'clock, the British opened a very heavy and destructive fire upon us, both by water and land. Their Congreve rockets flew like hailstones above us, and round shot and grape from every quarter. You have no idea of the battle. Our force was small, but how bravely they fought. Sir Lord George Provost feels bad. His land force may expect to meet their fate if our militia do their duty, but in time of action they were not to be seen. The action on water lasted only 2 hours and 10 minutes. The firing from their batteries has but just ceased. Ours is still continuing. The small arms now are just coming to action. I have no time to write any more. You must conceive what we feel, for I cannot describe it. I am satisfied that I can fight. I know I am no coward. Therefore, call on Mr. Loomis and drink my health, and I will pay the shot. 3 of my men are wounded by a shell which burst within 2 feet of me. The boat from the fleet, which has just landed under our fort, says the British Commodore is killed. Out of 300 on board their ship, 25 remain alive. Some of our officers, who have been on board, say the blood is knee-deep. Their force we have taken consists of one ship, 36 guns, one brig of 18 guns, and 2 sloops. Huzza! Huzza! 20 or 30 British prisoners taken by our militia have just arrived in fort. I can write no more, for the time grows dubious. Yours forever, William Miller. Give my compliments to all, and send this to my wife." If it should be necessary, the forbearance of the reader is again appealed to for noticing an incident which, if it is of no other value, gave the greatest possible interest to the letter of Mrs. Miller in the estimation of herself and family at the time of its reception. It is one of those mysterious phenomena, the occurrence of which it is hard to deny, while the principle or agency from which they spring it is not easy fully to explain. The Battle of Plattsburgh was fought on Sunday. The state of Mrs. Miller's health was such as to make her interest in the issue of the battle of the most affecting and absorbing character. She was near giving birth to a son, who is now living, and bears the strongest resemblance to his father of any one of the children. If there are any circumstances which would make it proper that an almost supernatural intercourse might be permitted between two souls which heaven has united, it must be at such a time. While the battle was raging, nearly 100 miles distant, Mrs. Miller became strangely affected. A hitherto unexperienced and unaccountable presentation was made to her mind, which to her was a demonstration of what was going on where she felt that so much was at stake. She was nearly frantic with agony, so that the friends who were with her became seriously alarmed on her account. Argument, ridicule, all the modes they could think of to restore her usual cheerfulness and self-command were alike unavailing. She could think and speak of nothing but the trouble at the North. The form of this presentiment was very simple, but certainly it was highly emblematic. As she expressed it, quote, "A dark, furious, smothering tornado rushed down on a poor, unsheltered flock of little birds," close quote. There was ground enough for such a comparison in the antagonist forces, though there was anything but an apprehended sweep of a destructive tornado in the last letter of her husband. But the coincidence of time was the mystery. The day passed, her agony subsided, but not her fears. The friends with her thought she had had a nervous time or was slightly insane. Nothing was heard from the scene of conflict at the North till near the close of Monday. The first intimation of the tidings to that family was the strong peal of the village bell. A member of the family was sent out to inquire its meaning, and the glad shout of victory was heard on every hand. A fleet horse and rider had brought the news and passed on south. The sound of victory was most welcome. That was all that patriotism might ask, but family affection could not rest till it had learned the price of victory. An old iron-hearted soldier has remarked that, quote, "The next calamity to a defeat in war is a triumph," close quote. Some must have fallen at Plattsburgh, and how many anxious hearts awaited the arrival of the next mail from the seat of war. That mail brought to Mrs. Miller the letter before referred to. It reads as follows. Fort Scott, September 12, 1814, 7 o'clock, morning. Dear wife, yesterday was a day of great joy. We have conquered. We have drove them. About 9 o'clock a.m. yesterday, the British fleet fired a salute as they passed Cumberland Head. It was a token for a general engagement. About 20 minutes after, they hove in sight. How majestic, how noble our fleet lay in Plattsburgh Bay, and, like a saucy Yankee, paid no attention to their royal salute. The British fleet still bearing down upon us, bold as a lion, in a moment we were all prepared for action. The British had thrown up a number of batteries on all sides of us. The next minute the cannon began playing, spitting their fire in every quarter. What a scene! All was dreadful. Nothing but roaring and groaning for about 6 or 8 hours. I cannot describe to you our situation. The fort I was in was exposed to every shot. Bombs, rockets, and shrapnel shells fell thick as hailstones. 3 of my men were wounded, and 1 killed, but none that were from Pulteney or that quarter. In 1 hour and 45 minutes, the enemy's fleet was conquered. My God, what a slaughter on all sides! Out of 300 on board of one ship, 24 only remained unhurt. I cannot describe to you the general joy. At sundown, our forts fired a national salute, accompanied by a tune called Yankee Doodle, and each gun was loaded with an 18-pound shot. This soon frightened our foe to that degree that, this morning at daybreak, not a soul was to be seen, and they went off in so great a hurry that not one article of their baggage could they carry away. Some they burnt, and some they left behind. Their loss in killed and wounded is immense, besides 100 taken prisoners and 300 or 400 deserters. Our loss was not so great, but considerable. Every officer and soldier is now singing for joy, and there is nothing now heard but the 11th day of September and Lord George Provost retreating for Canada. You may well conceive, by my unconnected mode of writing, that I am as joyful as any of them. A naval and land engagement within the compass of a mile or two and 15,000 or 20,000 engaged at one and the same time is superior to anything my eyes ever beheld before. How grand, how noble, and yet how awful! The roaring of cannon, the bursting of bombs, the whizzing of balls, the popping of small arms, the cracking of timbers, the shrieks of the dying, the groans of the wounded, the commands of the officers, the swearing of soldiers, the smoke, the fire, everything conspires to make the scene of a battle both awful and grand. The fort I was in was on the bank of the lake and in plain view of everything which passed. Remember me to all my friends, and in the meantime, accept of me as I am faithfully yours, William Miller. The triumph of the American arms at Plattsburgh was truly a signal one, and if ever it was proper to ascribe such an event to the Almighty, it was proper on this occasion. It is not very often the case, however, that an acknowledgment of this kind marks the official account of a battle as it does that of Commodore McDonough. It was perfectly in harmony with his well-known deportment at the time and with the common feeling which pervaded, in an unusual degree, the whole United States force engaged. Napoleon had beaten the mightiest armies that Europe had ever raised in an almost uninterrupted succession of battles during more than 10 years. The troops of England, with their allies, had now the reputation of having at last beaten Napoleon. And these English troops, with overwhelming numbers in their favor, entered the field against those of the United States at Plattsburgh. What then, in all human estimation, had this apology for an army to expect? One of the most sublime and appalling scenes in which it falls to the lot of man to enact a part is presented by the deadly encounter of fleets and armies. The attainment of a position, the skill and courage required in each division of the body to be brought into action, in order to work out the plan on which the success of the day is presumed to depend, the ability and promptness needed to comprehend and execute any maneuver, the necessity of which may not be foreseen, the success of a stratagem or a surprise, are so many points where the strength of the hostile forces is equal, in which the chances usually hang so much in doubt, that each man of the thousands in arms must feel his danger in the same proportion that he feels his insufficiency to direct all to the desired result. And this sense of insufficiency must naturally dispose each one to look for aid to a power above that of man. Such a feeling is the usual accompaniment of a battle where the chances are equally balanced. But when the strength of the forces is known to be very unequal, that party in the contest where the external weakness is felt, after all is done that devoted patriotism, union, intelligence, and skill can accomplish, must faint unless they are sustained by the hope of aid from on high, while the party which feel confident in their own resources often become profanely arrogant and fatally presumptuous. It is seldom that such an impressive exhibition of devout hope in God on one side and such a painful exhibition of self-confidence on the other side demands our attention as were manifested in the Battle of Plattsburgh. When the hour of deadly strife had come, every preparation having been made for action on the American side, and the attention of all on board the Saratoga was called to the Commodore, it is said that, in the stillness which was soon to give place to scenes of tumult so unsuitable to the day, the voice of McDonough was raised in fervent prayer to God for the fleet, the army, and the success of the American cause. But this was only an expression of the deep feeling of every heart. In such circumstances, the stoutest and even the profane felt the propriety of prayer, for all were humbled before God. This sense of its propriety, if nothing else, gave them a new feeling of strength for the conflict. And when the day closed with an assurance of victory, for it was thought to be hardly possible, even when the English fleet had struck their colors, the hand of God seemed to be so manifest to all that the hardest specimens of human nature in the fleet and army were seen in tears, while all were constrained to acknowledge their sense of providential favor. The result of this battle deeply impressed the mind of Mr. Miller. He refers to it in one of his published works in these words: "Many occurrences served to weaken my confidence in the correctness of deistical principles. I was led frequently to compare this country to that of the children of Israel, before whom God drove out the inhabitants of their land. It seemed to me that the Supreme Being must have watched over the interests of this country in an especial manner and delivered us from the hands of our enemies. I was particularly impressed with this view when I was in the Battle of Plattsburgh, when, with 1,500 regulars and about 4,000 volunteers, we defeated the British, who were 15,000 strong. We being also successful, at the same time, in an engagement with the British fleet on the lake. At the commencement of the battle, we looked upon our own defeat as almost certain, and yet we were victorious. So surprising a result, against such odds, did seem to me like the work of a mightier power than man." In another place, it will be seen that arrangements for celebrating the anniversary of this battle gave rise to the Christian effort which arrested the attention of Mr. Miller at the time of his conversion. What passed on board the English fleet, or in their camp, as a contrast to what took place on the part of the Americans, has not been stated. Its statement is not necessary, but as it was assigned to Captain Miller, with other officers, to prepare the body of the English Commodore for its interment, it may be remarked in passing that the sentiment said to have been rashly expressed by that personage when he took his accustomed drink at the close of his last meal imprecated such a termination of his career as he actually experienced. The first broadside from the American fleet split off a massive splinter from a spar or timber of the Confiance and dashed it with such force against Commodore Downie's person in the region of the vitals that he never breathed after he fell. It literally knocked the breath out of him. The generous sympathy shown to the wounded of their enemies and the honor paid to the dead by the Americans was as worthy of remembrance as the bravery with which they fought. Officers of the same rank received the same honors without regard to the nation in whose service they fell. Mrs. Downie, who tarried in Canada, expressed her high sense of the honors paid to her husband by an affecting and appropriate acknowledgment. The Battle of Plattsburgh was decisive as to any further hostilities in that quarter. A short armistice, arranged by the generals of the opposite forces, was followed by the ratification of peace. But the troops were still kept at their post, and scenes as painful, if not so destructive of human life, as those just noticed, passed in the American camp. One of Mr. Miller's letters speaks in becoming terms of the scenes referred to. Other things are mentioned in the same letter that might be omitted, but as the persons whose names are mentioned have passed away, and as a prominent trait in the character of the one who wrote the letter is here exhibited in its natural tenderness, the whole letter is inserted. Plattsburgh, October 28, 1814, 7 o'clock evening. Dear Lucy, again I have resumed my pen in hopes to beguile those lonesome hours which, although in camp, I assure you, are not a few. In my last letter, sent by David Wyman of West Haven, I informed you of the intended execution of a few criminals. There were 6 of them launched into the other world in a hurry today, and I think I had rather see 100 fall in action. You, perhaps, remember Spencer. He was a sergeant and gained the esteem of all his fellows. He is no more. He died yesterday of a fever, as is supposed, but I believe that a hopeless passion which he had formed for Charlotte Hyde hastened this end. I went to see him a few hours before his death. He was rational and appeared to be warned of his approaching fate. He mentioned his friends in Pulteney. He mentioned your name, regretted that he could not see you once more. But when he was going to mention the name of Charlotte, his speech failed him. He could only squeeze my hand and weep. I pitied him from my soul. "Young man," said I know what you would say. Endeavor to recover your health. You shall have a furlough, and go and see. "Ah, no," said he, "it is all over with me. A few hours, and I shall be no more." He hung to my hand, begged of me not to leave him, but my duty forced me, and with difficulty I tore myself from his grasp. I had him decently interred, and if any person was a mourner, I was one. Perhaps it would not be proper to mention this to Charlotte. You can do as you think best, as I believe you are capable of judging as correctly as I can. The remainder of the soldiers from Pulteney and that quarter are all well. I shall send this letter by Elnathan Phelps, Jr. I have sent to the post office for a letter this evening, and the mail had not arrived, therefore no letter from my Lucy. How unpropitious are these strong winds, or is my Lucy unkind? But a short time, and like Spencer, I shall be no more. It is a solemn thought. Yet, could I be sure of one other life, there would be nothing terrific. But to go out like an extinguished taper is insupportable. The thought is doleful. No, rather let me cling to that hope which warrants a never-ending existence, a future spring, where troubles shall cease and tears find no conveyance, where never-ending spring shall flourish, and love, pure as the driven snow, rest in every breast. Dear Lucy, do write to me, and let me know how you pass your time. Good evening. I am troubled. William Miller. As Mr. Miller has expressed his horror of the infidel doctrine of annihilation in the above letter, it may be proper here to show that it was this repulsive feature of deism which constituted the greatest difficulty connected with it in his mind. This fact is thus stated in one of his published works. Quote, "Before the close of this period, however," speaking of the period of his deistical life, "I began to suspect that deism tended to a belief of annihilation, which was always very abhorrent to my feelings. In the fall of 1812, as I was returning to Pulteney from the court at Rutland in company with Judge Stanley, I asked him his opinion respecting our condition in another state. He replied by comparing it to that of a tree, which flourishes for a time and turns again to earth, and to that of a candle, which burns to nothing. I was then satisfied that deism was inseparably connected with, and did tend to, the denial of a future existence. And I thought to myself that rather than embrace such a view, I should prefer the heaven and hell of the Scriptures, and take my chance respecting them. Still, I could not regard the Bible as inspired." Close quote. Another of his letters from the army is presented to the reader, rather to exhibit the ingenuity of its writer in administering a rebuke for what he supposed to be an omission on the part of his wife to forward the usual epistle to Camp Plattsburgh. It will be seen that an arrangement had been made for a weekly correspondence. The large bundle of letters written by him in fulfillment of this arrangement is still preserved. Each letter is numbered, and the whole furnishes an interesting illustration of the punctuality and order he carried into all the departments of life. This letter expresses the tender interest he felt in those at home. It shows that his pleasantry could adapt itself to the most serious subjects. And it undoubtedly presents a correct statement of his religious views at the time. It should be stated that the letter which he mourns the absence of, and which led him to suppose his wife must be no more, was sent by a lad who expected to leave Whitehall and go to Plattsburgh by water so as to get there about the time of the arrival of the mail. A storm detained the vessel some days, so that the letter was not received as intended. This afflicting letter, it is afflicting, full of irony as it is, reads as follows. Camp Plattsburgh, November 11th, 1814. Dear Lucy, have you departed this life? Are you gone to the world of spirits? Or are you so engaged that you could not devote 1 hour in a week to your humble servant? The following are the words you wrote me not long since, to wit, if I am alive, I shall write to you weekly, and put a letter into the post office every Monday morning, and ever since Wednesday noon, I have been dressed in mourning. Shall I ever see my Lucy again? I have often exclaimed, ah, no, she could not tell me a falsehood. She must be dead. What can I write if she is gone? I cannot write anything. She cannot hear me. I can only write to my children, into whose hands I hope this letter will fall. Dear children, you have lost your mother, and but a little while and your father must follow. Perhaps before you receive this, he will be no more. Prepare then, my children, to meet the frowns of fortune, and learn in your youth to repel the shafts of adversity. Your present time ought to be devoted to your studies. Remember the lives of your parents were short, and you know not the hour you will be called for. Life is uncertain, and you ought so to live as, when you come to die, that not one reflection will pass your mind, but that you have so lived as to merit the goodwill of all good men. Your first study ought to lead you to look up to the Supreme Being as the author of all things. When you learn His attributes, or as much as man is to know, you will ever keep in mind that He sees every action of your life, knows every thought, and hears every word. If you follow this rule, you cannot go far astray. You may be led for a moment into vices that human nature is subject to, but you cannot materially err, for in your cooler moments, conscience will point to you the road you ought to follow. You must never give way to adversity, nor be raised up in prosperity, for pride is equally as dangerous as cowardice, for to give way to the first shows a weak and cowardly mind, and the latter indicates a vain and haughty spirit. Begin the world as you would wish you had when you come to die. Endeavor to get the goodwill of all people, for it is better to have the good than the ill will of even a dog. Search not too far for vain and empty baubles. It is a more solid pleasure to do as you would be done by. Yet in this you will find the ingratitude of man. Put not too much dependence on human favor, for there are but few who walk the narrow path. Remember, my children, that your father has vainly sought the friendship of man, and never could he discover any friendship only where there was a dependence. In the small circle in which I now move, this rule is manifest. Here are 100 persons that depend upon me for every comfort, and each one professes a real love for me. Yet if I was a citizen, or one of their own rank, I could never expect more than a common friendship. Indeed, they seem to me like children, and together with you claim my highest support. If my Lucy is no more, and I am doomed to lead a solitary life, you must calculate to live for yourselves. What pecuniary help I can afford you, I will, and I expect it will be but small. What little worldly store I have left at home may be divided equally among you when you arrive to years of discretion. In the meantime, I hope, William, that you will set so good an example to your brothers and sisters as that, if they follow it, shall ensure them peace, love, and friendship here, and happiness in the world to come. May you remember the virtues of your parents and forget their vices. This is the constant prayer of your loving father, William Miller. If Lucy is no more, or if she has forgotten William Miller, then this letter is directed to William S. Miller, his oldest son. Mr. Miller remained at Plattsburgh as late as February of 1815, and although the English had removed their forces into Canada, so that there was no fighting with them, there were some bad Yankees whose cases called for occasional punishment. In the register of men tried and punished or pardoned, kept by our then military friend, we find nothing more severe inflicted by any court-martial of which Captain Miller was president than this. Quote, S.P. Private, January 20, 1815, Regiment Court-Martial. Crime, disobedience of orders, neglect of duty, and stealing. Sentence, to be ducked in the lake, picketed 2 hours, and have his whiskey ration stopped 60 days. Close quote. Rather a hard sentence for January. In prosecuting the business designated in the following order of General Macomb, he probably had an opportunity to make a flying visit to Pulteney. Headquarters, Plattsburgh, 3rd February, 1815. Orders, Captain Miller of the 30th Regiment will proceed immediately to Whitehall and procure clothing for the requisition of the commanding officer of his regiment, Alex Macomb. Mr. Miller's connection with the scenes of military life were drawing to a close. Peace had already been ratified, and shortly after the news of that event arrived, he received permission to take a last farewell of the actual service of a calling which was as uncongenial with the aspirations of his soul as any of the scenes of his former life had been. The permit, perhaps it should be called a discharge, is in this form. Burlington, June 18, 1815. Captain W. Miller has permission to depart till further orders, he having complied with the general orders as respects the 5-year men. By command, Jonathan H. Burton, Lieutenant and Adjutant, 30th Infantry. A few reflections on this period of Mr. Miller's life, and the mention of an incident or two of some interest, must close this chapter. Everybody is familiar with the fact that the army is a bad school of morality. Intemperance, licentiousness, gambling, fighting, stealing, profanity, and Sabbath breaking are the common vices of army life. It was the constant practice of these vices by those around him which sickened Mr. Miller of their society, and that he should escape entirely from the contamination would be too much to expect. However, it is both a matter of surprise and highly creditable to him that his moral integrity and habits were not affected to a hopeless extent. There were, however, some redeeming traits to the too generally dark moral picture of army life. There were a few men in the 30th Regiment of Infantry who were known as men of prayer and undoubted piety. And an incident in their history, which Mr. Miller has often spoken of with great interest, should be mentioned. One of these praying men, if memory has not failed in the case, was Sergeant Willie. His tent was occasionally used for the purpose of holding a prayer meeting. On one of these occasions, when Mr. Miller was the officer for the day, he saw a light in this tent, and wishing to know what was going on, as his duty required, he drew near and heard the voice of prayer. He said nothing at the time, but the next day, on recollecting it, he thought it was a good opportunity to try the sergeant's piety and indulge his own relish for a joke by calling Sergeant Willie to account for having his tent occupied by a gambling party the night before. When the sergeant appeared, Captain Miller affected great seriousness and spoke in a tone bordering on severity as follows. "You know, Sergeant Willie, that it is contrary to the Army regulations to have any gambling in the tents at night, and I was very sorry to see your tent lit up for that purpose last night. We cannot have any gambling at such times. You must put a stop to it at once. I hope I shall not have to speak to you again about it." The poor sergeant stood thunderstruck for a moment to hear such an imputation cast on himself and his associates. And then, hardly daring to look up, he replied, with the most touching simplicity, and in a manner which showed that he was alike unwilling to suffer the scandal of entertaining gamblers or to make a parade of his devotions, "We were not gambling, sir." Captain Miller was touched with his appearance, but still affecting greater severity than at first, being determined to press him to a confession, he said to the sergeant, "Yes, you were gambling, and it won't do. What else could have your tent lighted up for all the evening, if you were not gambling?" Sergeant Willie now felt himself under the necessity of being a little more explicit, and answered, in a manner deeply expressive of his grief and innocence, "We were praying, sir." Captain Miller by this time was almost in tears, and indicating, by a motion of his hand, that he was satisfied, and that the praying sergeant might withdraw, he continued alone for some time, sensibly affected by the courage manifested by these Christians in that ungodly camp, by the becoming deportment of their representative under such a serious scandal, and by the doubtful course he had taken in reference to them. There are but two particulars on which the writer has ever heard a hint that the subject of this memoir became in the least corrupted in his habits during his connection with the army. On one of these particulars, he has written as follows. "One day in May 1816, I detected myself in the act of taking the name of God in vain, a habit I had acquired in the service, and I was instantly convicted of its sinfulness." The other vice of his army life was that of gambling, particularly, if not exclusively, in the use of cards. To what extent he indulged the habit cannot be stated, but on returning home at the close of the war, he abandoned the practice totally and forever. Facts might be presented to show that Mr. Miller's stern regard for the principles of personal virtue, and especially his abhorrence of the slightest violation of the laws of chastity, exposed him to the raillery of his less scrupulous and even shameless brother officers. It is sufficient to say, what all who have any knowledge of the question will confirm, that his personal integrity and official honor was such, throughout his connection with the army, as to command in an almost unexampled degree the respect and affection of all who were under him as an officer, and the hearty confidence and esteem of his official associates. For years after the war closed, it was a common thing for his brethren in arms to turn aside from the great route of travel, 5 or 6 miles, only to enjoy a short interview with one to whom they were so strongly attached, and some of the less provident, feeling sure that he would receive them with a sort of fatherly sympathy, which a poor, unfortunate soldier seldom finds in the world, were accustomed to tarry with him some days or weeks at a time. One fact must be mentioned which will speak more than volumes in behalf of his commanding integrity, as it shows the place he occupied in the respect and confidence of the soldiers. After the war, two members of his company, who lived as neighbors in the extreme northern part of Vermont, had some business difficulties which grew to be so serious that they could hardly live together as neighbors on speaking terms, to say the least. This was a great affliction to themselves as brother soldiers, to their families, and to the whole neighborhood. These men had often thought of their former captain, though they were much older than he was, and wished the difficulties could be submitted to his examination and decision. But it was a long way to his residence, and the time and cost of the journey seemed too much to admit of such an arrangement. However, the matter became a source of so much trouble that the proposition was made by one and gladly accepted by the other, to visit Captain Miller, to submit the case to him by telling each his own story, and to abide by his decision. The long journey was performed by these old soldiers separately, as duelists go to the place of single combat. They arrived at Captain Miller's nearly at the same time. Arrangements were made for a hearing. Each told his story. The decision was made known after all the facts of the case had been duly considered. It was received in good faith by the parties. They took each other cordially by the hand, spent a little time with their captain, and returned to their homes in company as friends and brothers. These men, now far advanced in life, it is believed, are still living. Their names could be given if it were necessary. Paradoxical as it may appear, some of the most distinguished and honorable soldiers have been the most successful bloodless peacemakers, while, on the other hand, some of the most contemptible cowards, with peaceable pretensions always on their lips, have distinguished themselves by very little besides their successful contrivances to keep all engaged in war with whom they have had to do. Without claiming any special distinction for Mr. Miller on the score of what are styled brilliant achievements in the field of danger, the character of a great lover of peace belonged to him as a distinguishing personal trait. He delighted in peace, naturally. It is not known that he ever intentionally provoked a quarrel, and a considerable number of cases could be cited in which he has been called to perform the office of a peacemaker, and in the duties of which he has been remarkably successful. But enough. More must be left unwritten than it would be practicable or necessary to write. The watchful providence which guarded him in the hour of deadly peril, the long-suffering which spared him while neglecting the talents bestowed, or misusing them in rebellion against the giver, and that wisdom and grace which overruled all the dangers experienced and the derelictions practiced, as in many other persons of distinguished usefulness, demand our hearty adoration. The close of Mr. Miller's military life was to be the commencement of a new era in his history. The circumstances which preceded that change, the means and instrumentalities employed in its accomplishment, and the practical results which immediately followed in the circle of his acquaintance, must be left to another chapter.